It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, did Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump get a post-convention bounce? We'll find out the latest in the polling numbers with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First, Wisconsin's Medical Examining Board recently adopted new guidelines for prescribing opioids. The guidelines are part of larger efforts from the medical community and law enforcement to end prescription drug abuse. The decision was praised by Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel, who said in a statement that it would, quote, result in fewer opioid prescriptions, a more educated citizenry, and alternative options for treating chronic and acute pain.
Dr. Patrick Remington joins us now. He's a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and is also a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Board of Directors. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So what do you think about the new guidelines that the Wisconsin medical community is adopting?
Well, I think it's a good idea. It's been recognized for many years that opioids can have a downside. They're clearly useful in the treatment of chronic pain, particularly cancer-related pain that comes at the end of life. But when they're overused, they can be abused and lead to unnecessary addictions. And as we've heard, now accidental poisonings have overtaken car crashes as the leading cause of accidental death. So clearly the pendulum has swung too far in the use of opioid prescription drugs. And what we're trying to do is have a balance where it's used when appropriate, where they're used as appropriate, but not overused.
And we'll get into some of the specifics of these changes, but overall, how different, how significant will it be from the way that opioids have been prescribed in the past?
Well, this is a guideline, and it's a little bit unusual for the Medical Examining Board to be issuing a practice guideline. Normally, they license healthcare providers, physicians, and others, and also look out for physicians who are not practicing up to standards. And so that this is a bit unusual. The legislature actually enacted a law permitting the medical examining board to issue a guideline. But it is a guideline. It doesn't mandate a practice in one way or the other. It requests that physicians consider prescribing opioids sparingly, informing their patients about the potential downsides, that you could become addicted and even die as a result of an overdose, and most importantly, avoid opioids as the first option to treat pain. Really, the best approach is to understand the causes of pain and to look at non-opioid treatment options as opposed to simply writing a prescription for an opioid as a first choice.
Let's dig into some of those specifics that you mentioned. Let's start with that last one. What are some of the options that these guidelines encourage providers to make their patients familiar with before going the opioid route?
Well, first of all, many times pain can be managed without any drugs. It's up to the physician to talk with the patient about the level of pain, to assess whether this is pain that requires a treatment. Second, there are what we call non-pharmacologic treatments of of pain, so that acetaminophen or what we call the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, things like ibuprofen or Aleve, can be used. And so the most important thing is to consider whether the pain is sufficient to be treated, and then are non-opioid medications that can be used instead.
You also said that physicians were getting the recommendation to give their patients as much information as possible about what taking opioids can mean for them. What are some of the specific things that patients should know when they're starting or continuing a course of opioid pain medications?
Well, first of all, opioids aren't necessarily the best treatment for pain. I think a lot of people assume that if you don't get an opioid for pain, that you're not getting the best medicine, and that's absolutely not true. There are many non-narcotic options for treating pain, and so first, patients have to understand there are many ways to treat pain without opioids. Second is to understand that they are addicting, that people can become addicted quite quickly, and that leads to a spiral of seeking behavior and problems down the road. And finally, there are many people in Wisconsin and throughout the nation who are dependent upon opioids and who abuse opioids. And so this, if opioids are prescribed when not needed and not used, they can find their way into the community and then be used for treatment of pain, but as a drug of abuse.
So you did say, Dr. Remington, that this is not a mandate. These are guidelines. So what incentive will there be for getting doctors to change their prescribing habits and follow these guidelines?
Well, first of all, call-in or radio shows like Central Time are a good way for people to become more aware of this as a public health issue. So simply encouraging patients to talk with their physicians and even asking if you are necessary. Whether they've actually encouraged a physician to have a conversation.
I'm really sorry, but we're actually losing you there, Dr. Remington. We'll have to leave it there, but thank you for joining us. That was Dr. Patrick Remington. He's a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Board of Directors and joined us to talk about new guidelines for the prescribing of opioid medications in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we continue our series of candidate interviews with Paul Nealon, the Republican candidate running against Speaker Paul Ryan for Congress.
Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on national politics with Harry Enten from 538.com. With both conventions over, the major party campaigns are looking for a post-convention bounce in the polls, and Republican leaders are worried about a string of controversial comments from candidate Donald Trump. Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst at 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, before we get into some of the latest news here, let's look at this whole post-convention bounce concept, every candidate hoping they come out with a big jump. What did we see first from Donald Trump, then from Hillary Clinton?
So we saw that Donald Trump did get a bounce out of the Republican National Convention of about 3 to 4 points, which is a good bounce, but historically speaking isn't traditionally large and is, in fact, below average if you look all the way back to, say, 1964. But then Hillary Clinton came out of the Democratic National Convention with about a 7 percentage point bounce. So she had a larger bounce than Donald Trump, and it's currently showing up in the polls right now. And she is the favorite, at least at this point in the campaign.
Harry, a lot of politically committed people have been watching this election closely for a long time, over a year, and nerds like you and me, we've been paying close attention. But is this the time, now that we have the candidates really in place, that everybody, a lot more people, are seriously tuning into this race?
Yeah, we should expect to see that about now. It may, in fact, be a month from now. Traditionally, at least over the past few decades, the conventions are held in, at least the last convention is held in August, and that wasn't the case this time around. In fact, the last convention, the Democratic National Convention, was held in late July. So usually we say it's around Labor Day when people really start tuning in, but that's also tied to the conventions. So I would say about from now till Labor Day, we should expect voters who aren't nerds or perhaps have lives to start tuning into the campaign, though I would like to say I have at least a little bit of a life.
I think you do. I don't, though. Well, the latest polling came before a long string of controversial moments from Donald Trump. Here's just a few of them.
He's not going into Ukraine, okay? Just so you understand. He's not going to go into Ukraine.
Actually, I was only kidding. You can get the baby out of here.
And I'm afraid the election's going to be rigged. I have to be honest.
If you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. You tell me, but plenty of people have written that.
So in addition to those, Putin and Ukraine, the Gold Star parents, the baby, in a print interview also, he said he would not endorse Paul Ryan or John McCain in their primaries. Harry, lots of top Republicans were seeing reports. They're worried. We're hearing phrases like an intervention is needed, break glass in case of emergency, exit ramp. What's going on?
I think that this has just been a horrible 72 hours or 96 hours. It's just been a terrible last week for Donald Trump. I mean, you saw the polling come out of the convention, and then he just can't keep his mouth shut. He needs to win every fight according to himself, and so he keeps needling people when it's clear that the public isn't on his side. And I think Republicans in Washington have had enough of that. I think they're obviously not favorably disposed to him in the first place. And then he starts making these comments and, you know, you start seeing perhaps effects down ballot. You know, one instance of that being immediate is obviously Trump refusing to endorse Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan's probably still going to win that primary, but still. And I think Republicans are very fed up. And they are deciding, you know what, enough is enough. But to be clear, just because they say they're going to stage an intervention or do whatever, that doesn't mean they're actually going to do anything. They may just be trying to send a signal to Donald Trump that you've gone too far this time. Look, Donald Trump is the Republican nominee for President of the United States, and until I actually see him stand on a stage and say otherwise, there's nothing that anybody else can really do because he's the one with all the power right now.
The big message for a while now from people like Reince Priebus, from Donald Trump himself, was that after he locked up the primary campaign, after he became the nominee, presumptive, he was going to pivot and start sounding more presidential. Donald Trump said himself he was going to start sounding more presidential. Not seeing that so far, even now that the conventions are over.
I would say not, unless Donald Trump has a different dictionary definition of pivot than I do. No, Donald Trump is Donald Trump. He can't help himself. This is the same Donald Trump that was running the primaries. There's nothing that he's saying now that should be too surprising to anyone, unless you truly believe that Donald Trump was capable of change. But there hasn't been any indication that Donald Trump is really capable of change. Maybe the one bit of good news for him over the last week is that some fundraising numbers came out, which indicated that, in fact, that he's gotten his act together, at least somewhat on that. But in terms of actual actions on the campaign trail and statements that he's made, no sign of a pivot. And you know what? That would be perfectly fine if he was leading in the polls as he was in the primary. But in the general election, more times than not, the vast majority of times, more times than not, he's been trailing. And he trails right now with no sign that he's able to change his course.
Some people have looked at the polls and said, oh, it's this gold star parent thing. Are we seeing the impact of those comments, do you think, in polling yet?
I think it's very difficult to distill out what exactly is the cause. We know that conventions traditionally have provided bounces to candidates, and Hillary Clinton got a bounce coming out of the Democratic National Convention. Whether or not the Kong controversy had something to do with that, perhaps it did. It could be that we're going to see a lingering bounce, perhaps longer than we expect to do because of it. Or it could be the case that, in fact, the Kong controversy, while has revved up a lot of people, hasn't necessarily changed the polls very much. We don't know that yet, but I'm sure that as the next couple of days come out, and if Clinton's lead continues to expand, then I think it's clear that this Kong controversy has had an effect. Otherwise, we can just say that perhaps it has or perhaps it hasn't.
A lot of the criticism of Donald Trump by Republicans has come in the past from people he was running directly against, who he tangled with in the past. This week, Chris Christie, one of the first high-profile Republicans, disagreed with him publicly on the Gold Star parents, the Kahn family, back and forth. Newt Gingrich used the phrase self-destructive, describing Trump's campaign. Newt Gingrich, again, a prominent Republican, early adopter of the Trump campaign. If those people who have set themselves anyway closest to Donald Trump are saying these things, is that a worry? Is that something that Trump's campaign should be worried about?
I think it's absolutely something they should be worried about. I mean, there were some talks that, you know, Trump was trying to send messages to surrogates, let's jump off the Kahn controversy. But I should also point out with Chris Christie and Newt Gingrich, there was a reason why they might have been so nice to Donald Trump before this, and that was because they believed that they had a shot to be his vice presidential running mate. And now, obviously, that's no longer possible unless he's going to drop Mike Pence from the ticket, which I think is probably less probable than Donald Trump dropping out of the race, which itself is not very probable at all.
Another twist in the vice presidential side of things, you mentioned Mike Pence. He endorsed Paul Ryan in his primary with Donald Trump, said he wasn't quite ready to do. And Pence said Trump had encouraged him to endorse Paul Ryan. So a mixed message there coming from the two halves of the ticket.
I think that we often assign far too much credit to the Trump campaign that they have any idea what they're doing. Look, one of the reasons that I think Mike Pence was picked in the first place was because he was close with Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan praised the pick when Pence was selected. So it's no surprise to me that Pence is getting behind Paul Ryan at this time, but to assign any sort of credit to the Trump campaign saying, Donald Trump encouraged Mike Pence to endorse Paul Ryan, I don't think that we have any basis in fact to actually back that up, or, you know, besides maybe a little statement. But, you know, a campaign say things all the time. All we know is what Donald Trump has said on the record, and that is that he isn't quite ready to endorse Paul Ryan. And that's really what I would go on.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at the latest in national politics. Another worry for Republicans is what happens down ballot, not very far down ballot in things like Senate and House races. Donald Trump scheduled to come to Green Bay, Wisconsin on Friday. People not in attendance as of airtime: Governor Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, Senator Ron Johnson in a reelection campaign there. Are we going to see a lot of Republicans, in election campaigns or not, out there campaigning next to Donald Trump?
I think if I were they, I would run as far away as I possibly could. You know, I'm actually working on a story right now which looks at the 10 most competitive Senate races nationwide, including in the state of Wisconsin. And if you look across those 10 races, what you see consistently pretty much is that Donald Trump is doing worse than the Republican Senate candidate in those states. That is, there's the potential that he is dragging them down. It's bad coattails for them. And so if I were they, I would run very, very far away. We're already seeing that in a number of states. And I guess what is so amazing to me, which I really have never heard of before, was just yesterday, Donald Trump is going after Kelly Ayotte, who is in a very tough matchup for re-election in the state of New Hampshire, and he goes after her. For what reason? He says he's running ahead of her. Not surprisingly, if you follow Donald Trump's statements, that wasn't exactly true. In fact, Kelly Ayotte is polling better in New Hampshire than Trump is. But what is this? I would just run as far away from him as I possibly could, and that may not work. But, hey, if Donald Trump is losing in your state, why would you want to be tied to him?
And to be clear, the people I listed have not said they're avoiding Donald Trump. They all have alternate schedule plans for when Donald Trump is here.
Sure, that's a nice way of putting it. You know, I often might say to someone, oh, no, I already had plans, you know, for dinner. Secretly, though, I'm actually just watching old political tapes at home because I wanted to avoid them.
Now, interestingly, there is another major party candidate in this presidential race named Hillary Clinton. With all of this talk going around, on all these controversial comments from Donald Trump, is that sucking the air out of the room for, A, what she wants to talk about, and B, negative things she doesn't want to talk about that Republicans could be, like her statements about whether she was truthful, as the FBI sees it, on email comments, or this Iran money deal around the time some prisoners were released from Iran? There are a lot of things that Republicans probably want to be talking about that they're not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, Hillary Clinton is not particularly well-liked. Even after the Democratic National Convention, more people dislike her than like her. Usually that would mean very, very bad things for a candidate. But fortunately for Clinton, Trump is sucking up all the oxygen in the room. The statement that you spoke about in terms of James Comey and the FBI that was on, a Sunday talk show this past week, she was given four Pinocchios for that statement by the Washington Post, and no one is talking about it, not a single person. And the reason is that Trump is sucking all the oxygen out of the room. You know, they sometimes say that all press is good press, but sometimes it isn't, and I think Donald Trump is proving that right now. And Hillary Clinton, I think, understands that. I think she's more than happy to give some of the limelight to Trump if he keeps putting it on himself in a bad way.
Is the race still a race to be the least disliked candidate between Clinton and Trump?
By the definitions that we set forth, absolutely. I mean, Hillary Clinton is still disliked by more people than liked. Donald Trump is disliked by even more people. So I think it still is a race between the lesser of two evils. But to be clear, Donald Trump is a lot more disliked than Hillary Clinton. If you look at their net favorability ratings, Donald Trump's is 20 percentage points worse than Hillary Clinton's, according to Gallup. That makes Clinton at this point the favorite going into the fall.
Some of the messaging at the Democratic convention seemed clearly pitched toward Republicans who didn't want to vote for Donald Trump, so-called moderate Republicans, I guess. It seems like the Hillary Clinton campaign is still trying to do that. You wrote about this, Harry, looking at what kind of Republican voter was more likely to maybe jump ship from Donald Trump and go to Hillary Clinton. What did you see?
Well, essentially what we saw was we got such a large sample size, so we were able to drill down. And what it seems to be is the people that are most likely to jump ship, the Republicans most likely to jump ship and vote for Hillary Clinton, are people who self-identify as moderates, who have at least a college degree, and are somewhere between, say, the Northeast going into just east of Wisconsin, basically the eastern part of the Midwest region. And not surprisingly, what you see is that Hillary Clinton is picking up endorsements, or at least people who are saying they're not going to vote for Trump from that region. For instance, Richard Hanna, who's a representative from upstate New York, has been the first Republican in Congress to come out and say explicitly that he is going to vote for Hillary Clinton. We saw Charlie Dent, who's a prominent Republican from the state of Pennsylvania, saying he cannot vote for Donald Trump at this time. And so to me, you know, that could be very bad news for Trump, because part of that region where you expect Hillary Clinton to pick up votes from these moderate Republicans jumping ship, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, these are all states that Donald Trump has targeted, and it's going to be very difficult for him to pick up those states if a third of moderate Republicans with a college degree are going for Hillary Clinton.
Right. Those are the states people keep pointing toward as must-win states if Donald Trump is going to take, if he's going to keep everything that Mitt Romney won, which is a question mark in some states, and add enough states to win. Ohio, Pennsylvania are the ones that people talk about a lot.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people talk about those states because they believe that Donald Trump has an appeal to working class white voters, that is traditionally white voters without a college degree. But what's that worth if you're losing a ton of ground white voters with a college degree? You know, you're maybe filling one side of the tube, but the other side is wide open and you're leaking support. And that's what seems to be the case with Donald Trump, which is why, in fact, he's trailing in the polls in all three of those states at this time.
Harry, from your perch in the national media scene, are people going to be watching Wisconsin in this presidential election, or are we going to be just a sideshow?
I think that, obviously, I'm always watching Wisconsin, but I think that it's one of the states that most likely will stay in the Democratic column if you're looking at the 538 forecast. And you're also looking at the Senate polls right now. Russ Feingold does hold a lead, which is larger than some of the leads in other of the Senate battleground states.
And very, very briefly, Harry, what are you watching for next in the polls?
I want to see whether or not this Hillary Clinton bounce sticks, or whether it rises, or do we see some fall back of it. If it falls back, then we have a real race on our hands. But by the end of the month, if Hillary Clinton is up by what she's up by right now in a lot of the polls, this race is going to be very difficult for Donald Trump to win.
Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538.com, looking at the latest in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we talk to the Republican candidate running against Speaker of the House Paul Ryan in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, recent weather conditions have been great for the corn crop, which may actually be bad for farmers. We'll find out why.
First, we've been inviting candidates running in Wisconsin's congressional primaries to join us on Central Time and on the Joy Cardine Show.
The Wisconsin primaries will take place on August 9th, and this week we're interviewing candidates from Wisconsin's 1st District, where Speaker of the House Paul Ryan is the incumbent.
We talked to Democratic candidates Ryan Solon and Tom Bry earlier this week. You can hear their interviews on WPR.org. Now we're turning to the Republican side, where Paul Nealon is challenging Speaker Ryan. Speaker Ryan is scheduled to join us tomorrow. Paul Nealon joins us now. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be on with you.
Well, first of all, why did you decide to run for Congress?
As you know, I'm a businessman. I've run businesses all over the globe. And this Trans-Pacific Partnership that Paul Ryan is the mercenary champion of, I read about that. I read what Senator Sessions wrote on this terrible, terrible trade deal and how it gives up U.S. sovereignty and it was going to undermine the wages of workers here in the United States. And, you know, it was so difficult to get information on it, I literally had to go to the New Zealand website and double fact-check everything in that document. And I wrote to Speaker Ryan, I called his office, I wrote to the governor because I know that they are friends, and I said, this is a terrible trade deal. Article 27 gives up U.S. sovereignty. I just got my fifth U.S. patent 2 weeks ago. This trade deal reduces the length of patents. It'll bring foreign workers to replace us in our jobs, and it will absolutely undermine our ability to trade in the world. And it's being sold. Here's the insidious thing. It is being sold to America as it's a free trade deal. You have to put finger quotes around free trade because it's anything but free trade. It's 5,500 pages of regulations and rules that only benefit big corporations. And you'll see who's lobbying for this. It's the same people that are putting money in Paul Ryan's campaign coffers. He's got $10 million in his campaign war fund, $0 of which, as of his last report, he put in there himself. I started out at 18 years old in a factory, and it took me 12 years at night to get my engineering degree, and eventually I ran that factory, and I've run factories all over the United States, including in 2008, 2009 in Delavan, Wisconsin, one of a Fortune 500's flagship businesses, where I was responsible for Buffalo, New York, Chicago, Delavan, Mexico City, and Modesto, California. And we grew through the downturn from a $150 million business to $180 million. And they said, hey, Neilan, you did so great. We want you to go run all of our businesses in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. So I went and lived overseas for over 2 years, almost 3 years. And I learned very quickly it is not the United States of Europe. And trade deals like this that undermine U.S. sovereignty, Article 27 sets up an unelected commission, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Commission, and it will be a group of bureaucrats who will be making rules and regulations that the U.S. Congress can't change.
Well, Paul, I want to jump in. People have made the case that these trade agreements, call them free or whatever you want, actually can benefit a place like Wisconsin, giving markets to Wisconsin farmers, Wisconsin factories for that matter. Do you see some plus side? Can we have a better fair trade deal by tweaking this, not scrapping the whole thing?
No, what we need to do is, and that's a great question. I'm all for trade. I'm all for bilateral trade agreements, country to country. And here's why you want bilateral trade agreements. This trade agreement in particular is largely led by Japan. And Japan brought in all of their smaller, awkward cousins, call it, smaller countries, because every nation gets one vote. So there's three of us on the phone right now. If each of us had one vote, who's leading? Paul Ryan's selling this as we need to lead. So if each one of us has one vote, who's leading? Nobody. Nobody's leading. You can't lead with one vote. And no businessman in his right mind would sign a contract that's a living document that says, okay, there's 12 countries in this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Everybody gets one vote. And we can change the document after it's been signed. So why would I sign a document? Why would we sign a document that we know the other countries are willing to change the document, and if they have a majority vote, it'll be changed? And this thing about Wisconsin farmers, the thing you have to remember, let's take Japan, for instance. A Wisconsin farmer or anybody in agriculture, any imaginable agricultural product, it is subject to being sold to the country itself. You're not selling to a Japanese consumer. You're not selling to a Japanese distributor. You have to get a certificate from the country of Japan. And they already have their agricultural minister on record as reassuring their agricultural people, don't worry, we're not going to issue very many of those certificates. So the only people that will win, the only people that will get these certificates are the big agribusinesses, the ones who are lobbying for it. They will put small farms, small medium farms, under such immense pressure, because if you think about it, the way this trade agreement is set up, every country has to have standards, right? Well, in the United States, with dairy, I've built a bunch of product for dairy processing, pumps, valves, heat exchangers. I'm an engineer, so the businesses I run are highly engineered businesses. You have to comply to the PMO, the pasteurized milk ordinance. And you have to, so that's administered by the FDA or the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. Those standards are very high. And we have chain of custody from the food that the cows eat to how the cows are handled to how the milk is transported, how the milk transport trucks are washed and cleaned and cared for, how long the milk sits at any given point along the way, how it's processed into milk from the milk reception unit through the dairy, how from the dairy to the cheese factory and how the cheese factory processes. I've put a bunch of equipment in cheese factories around the world, a lot in Wisconsin, I might add. And so we have standards, very, very high standards of quality which protect our kids, which protect our families. However, you look at another country, and they have very low standards. Let's say Vietnam.
Actually, I think we get the point that other countries have poor standards. I want to move on to some other issues apart from trade. As we talk to Paul Nealon, candidate for Congress in the 1st District Republican primary, voting next week. You've mentioned this has kind of become a national election, Paul, and you've criticized the incumbent, Paul Ryan, for not wholeheartedly supporting Donald Trump in the race, and that's brought a lot of national attention, including from Donald Trump himself, to your campaign. Why is that important for voters in the 1st District to watch for?
Well, it's important because he's our standard bearer. It's either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And so Paul Ryan has a responsibility to the team, the party, the group that he is representing to bring unity. And he is bringing disunity because Speaker Ryan is bought and paid for. I hate to say it, but honestly, somebody who has $10 million in his campaign coffers from great big corporations, we just don't pay enough here in Wisconsin's 1st District. Can you name a time when Paul Ryan worked as hard for Wisconsin workers and veterans and families as he has for his corporate donors? There isn't a time. There simply isn't a time. And just back on that other topic real quick, the reason I brought up the two standards, it costs a lot of money in the United States to maintain those standards. If you have very low standards and it doesn't cost very much, it'll be a lot easier for others to import here, because the only thing that treaty says is you have to have standards. It doesn't say they have to be equal. So by no stretch of the imagination is Vietnam going to implement the pasteurized milk ordinance. They are not going to implement the same stringent levels that we have here. So that trade deal would allow foreign corporations to sue Wisconsin. They could sue, if they tried to bring their product here and we said, wait, it doesn't match our standards, they could sue us. And Canada has been railing against this, that it's going to be the explosion of corporations all over the globe attacking local municipalities. And you know that our local municipalities can't handle attacks by lawfare, by lawyers who are going to come in, and those corporations are going to take money, they're going to take food off of the tables of Wisconsin families because our taxes will go up in order to pay for these things. It's an insidious trade deal. I've been in business 30 years. I've sold things, bought things all over the world. Bilateral trade's the way to do it.
We're hearing from Paul Nealon. He's a Republican candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District Republican primary. Speaker Paul Ryan is the incumbent there.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Paul Nealon? What should Congress focus on next year? And if you live in the 1st Congressional District, what are the most important issues in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after a short break here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Paul Nealon. He's a candidate for Congress in the 1st District Republican primary, where Speaker Paul Ryan is the incumbent.
And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for the candidate? If you're from the southeastern part of the state, what issues are most important in your community? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what issues you think Congress needs to focus on. That's 800-642-1234. 3-4.
Paul, before we get to our callers, and briefly so we can get through some more issues, you mentioned jobs, workers in that area, thinking about workers at the GM plant in Janesville, which is closed. What specifically would you do to help create jobs in your area that Paul Ryan hasn't done?
Oh, well, you know, there's a combination of things. You know, bilateral trade agreements are fantastic, but we've got countries like China and Japan and others who are using currency manipulation against us. China alone has taken 8 million jobs out of this country and $800 billion. And it's widely known that they are manipulating their currency, which allows them to bring product over here more cheaply. And there is a mechanism called a scaled tariff. And a scaled tariff is fully legal within existing trade agreements, trade deals. If we implemented the scaled tariff, we would bring hundreds of billions of dollars into the U.S. Treasury. And, you know, we're knocking on $20 trillion in debt right now. They will still continue to sell to us because we are the market. If anybody says to you, oh, well, they'll stop selling to us, well, okay. So what, are they just going to shut all their factories down and they're going to send the product somewhere else? I mean, if they can send the product somewhere else, don't you think they would be doing that too now? China doesn't have the wealth of resources like the United States does. And as soon as we put them on a level playing field with us, what will happen is we will have a better playing field for U.S. manufacturing to thrive. And then we wouldn't be talking about a minimum wage. We would be talking about $25, $30 factory jobs. And each one of those factory jobs supports several other jobs. You know, we all have to have a family wage or a working wage, and we have to be sensitive to any of these jobs being shifted overseas. It has to be done. But we can't do that. Paul Ryan has worked against legislation that would address China's currency manipulation. He has undermined that process. And something else that he's undermined, Paul Ryan is responsible for bringing debate to the floor of the House on these wars that we're fighting all over the globe. The authorization to use military force ran out. They signed it in 2002. We executed all of those missions that we needed to accomplish, and it ran out. But as you've seen, we have boots on the ground everywhere, and if it's necessary to do that, Paul Ryan has been asked 4 times now by Congress to debate this on the floor. He won't debate this on the floor. He won't even debate me on this trade deal that he thinks is so great. And if he really thought it was so great, and his donors really want it, you would think it would be great, wouldn't you? And he'd be able to stand up in front of Wisconsin and say, look at this great trade deal. The only problem is, I know the trade deal. I've read it. I know chapter and verse that this thing is going to hurt U.S. workers. It's going to hurt the lowest people on our totem pole trying to climb up the ladder, who have just gotten out of school, who are just at the lowest entry level. Foreign corporations will be able to bring their workers into this country, as if it isn't bad enough that we don't have enough jobs to go around.
Talking to Paul Nealon, candidate for Republican 1st District primary, running against Paul Ryan next week. Want to get to some of our callers now at 800-642-1234. Diane is with us in Anago now. Diane, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about health care. Paul Ryan ran on the platform of stopping Obamacare and controlling costs on health care, and instead what we have now, my husband and I have personally seen a substantial increase in our premium and our deductible almost doubling. What would you do differently to make health care more affordable for people?
Diane, thanks for the call. Paul?
Yeah, there are exchanges that we can do that are different than the Obamacare exchanges. They exist out there now. So I'm not a proponent of Obamacare. And in fact, I bought into Paul Ryan's suggestion that we would undo Obamacare, but he really didn't do that. We refer to him as Proposal Paul because he proposes a lot, but he doesn't really get a lot done. Unless, of course, you're a Puerto Rico hedge fund investor, then he'll get you bailed out. Paul Ryan does a lot of election year politicking, political engineering. He tells you he's for securing the border. He'll tell you that he's for making things safe. He'll tell you that he's for jobs. But Paul Ryan has gotten three pieces of legislation passed in 18 years. He renamed a post office. He got the excise taxes changed on arrows. And he passed some gobbledygook truth in legislating. So we have the greatest medical industry in the world, greatest medical thing, and it's been undone with Obamacare because it was so poorly implemented. And a short discussion like this is not really the time frame, but if you all recall, it was suggested that we would save $2,500 a year per family, and you could keep your doctor. And I don't think either of those two things came true for your caller. And we just heard her say that Paul Ryan said he was going to do something and he didn't do something. So I think, you know, I am running on a platform of getting things done. I've absolutely saved factories in the United States. I've closed factories. I just closed a factory in Canada and brought those jobs back to the United States, to the East Coast, and I moved work from the East Coast out to Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. And I closed down the better part of a Mexican facility in 2013 and 14 and brought all those jobs back to Tallapoosa, Georgia, more profitably, I might add. I also brought product lines back from a company that I hired on with that was in China, and I brought those jobs back to the United States. You can do that if you are a smart business guy and you've got experience and you can motivate teams. So I can work with Congress. I can work with other members in Congress to come up with a better solution than what Paul Ryan's hawking.
I want to ask Paul, because we just have a couple minutes left. How do you get that done? Paul Ryan has had to contend with a Democratic president who would veto the repeated times that the House passed Obamacare repeals. There might be a Democratic president you'd have to work with. There might be a filibuster-proof minority or even a majority of Democrats in the Senate. How would you work with those Democrats to accomplish some of what you're talking about?
Well, hey, Paul Ryan is representative for Democrats in this district. He's a representative for Republicans in this district and independents and libertarians and Tea Partiers. He's the representative for everybody. But he certainly doesn't act like it. He certainly doesn't work on behalf of working families here in Wisconsin. And that's what I've done my whole life. I've worked to grow businesses. And I got into a Fortune 200 because when my kids were in high school, I didn't want to move them out of their high school when our factory was moved from Delaware to Florida. And so, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. I ran businesses on the East Coast. My kids got into college, and a consulting company that I started in the late 90s, early 2000s, launched me into Fortune 200. And I know how to run businesses. Paul Ryan, he blames things on the president that aren't the president's fault. He's blamed a number of things on this president that aren't the president's fault. He blames it on the administration. The administration has nothing to do with whether or not Paul Ryan brings a floor debate on authorization to use military force. The framers of the Constitution never intended a president could wage war around the world like we see right now, and without being a check from Congress. That's Congress's role. Article 1, Section 8 says it is Congress's role to bring war. And if they debated that and they approved it, then everything would be fine. But he blames it on the administration that they don't have an authorization to use military force. How's that Obama's fault? I mean, it's absurd in the extreme for Paul Ryan to blame Obama for that when it's his role alone.
We'll leave it there, Paul. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, have a great day. Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Paul Nealon. He's a candidate for Congress in the 1st District Republican primary, where he's running against Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Speaker Ryan is scheduled to join us tomorrow at this time here on Central Time. We also talked to the two Democratic primary candidates in the 1st District earlier this week. You'll be able to find all of our public radio interviews with candidates around Wisconsin and a lot more election information at wisconsinvote.org, including voting places and times, information about how to vote in Wisconsin, sometimes a moving target with changes to the law in the courts lately, and of course, this series of candidate interviews. Find all that and more over at wisconsinvote.org. Happy 90th birthday today to a musical legend who's still making music decades into his career.
Singer Tony Bennett marks his 90th birthday today. He scored his first big hits back in 1951, and he's best known for his renditions of Rags to Riches and I Left My Heart in San Francisco. He recorded a duet album with Lady Gaga a couple years back, and they're talking about doing another one.
A birthday celebration concert is scheduled for December, televised with Lady Gaga, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, Elton John, Billy Joel. The list goes on and on. Judith, you've seen Tony Bennett in concert.
I did. I saw him here in Madison. We took my parents to it as a special gift. And I have to say, I always liked him, but I wouldn't have said I was a huge fan. But boy, it was a great experience. It felt like the only place he wanted to be in the world that night was singing to us.
So he was in his 80s at the time,
yes.
And he's showing up, and he's giving it
his
all.
He's giving it
his
all, and it just felt, it was in the Overture Center, so a large hall, but it felt very intimate. You know, it was a truly enjoyable evening.
A happy birthday to Tony Bennett from Central Time.
We know that you're bound to answer when we propose.